The House Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. And we do have a quorum, so let's see, I'm going to go to my left today. Would Representative Cagle, have you had a chance to look over the minutes from February 8th? I'm sorry, the minutes from February 6th. And if would you care to bring a motion to approve the minutes?
I will move to approve the minutes.
Okay. Representative Cagle moves approval of the minutes from the February 6th meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes of February 6th are approved. Okay. I've been looking forward to this day. I think we have a couple of very interesting experts in the area of transportation. So it's kind of a wonkish day. We're going to hear, you know, how the folks at the U talk about and think about transportation, and hopefully this will help us as we think about where Minnesota's transportation is in the future, what it might look like, and so on. So I'm going to first bring up Professor David Levinson. And he's been at the University of Minnesota for quite a number of years. Professor teaches courses in transportation policy, planning and deployment, transportation systems analysis, transportation economics, just to sort of start us off thinking. And maybe I know you've mentioned the Center for Transportation Studies, and perhaps you could just let us know really how that figures into, you know, how the U and how it's involved in transportation. But welcome, Professor, and please have a seat. And you're going to stand. Oh, of course. Professors.
He's a lecturer.
Oh, okay.
We're at the lecturer.
Yes. We can adjust, but I wonder if our microphone will pick you up.
Am I loud?
We might need to have you sit in front of the microphone. Oh, unfortunately.
Am I loud enough? Okay.
What do we think? I think we.
You guys don't have to sit back where I'm.
Okay. Okay, so for the recording, can you at least introduce yourself into the microphone and tell us? Okay.
I'm David Levinson. I am formerly a professor at the University of Minnesota, affiliate faculty member, University of Minnesota Department of Civil, Environmental, and Geoengineering, and an affiliate with the Center for Transportation Studies, which is an organization that helps facilitate research at the university in the area of transportation, and helps organize MnDOT research projects in particular, sort of its most relevant relationship to the state of Minnesota. And they've done other studies on behalf of the state legislature in the past, most notably on value capture, in which I was a part.
So I wonder we'd all probably enjoy it all much more if you were to sit, because it will pick you up and amplify you, and I think that would help for everybody who's here and in the audience. So thanks much.
All right. So why are we here? Or more precisely, why are we here? Now, I'm here because you're here. It would be sort of dumb for me to be here if you weren't here. I'd be talking to an empty audience. And why are you here? Well, you're here to listen to me and to Mr. O'Toole. And why are we here at the State Office Building? It's about access, because we want to access policy ideas. All right? That's what transportation is about. It's about connecting people to destinations. It's not about congestion or speed, although that's part of it. It's about connecting people to destinations. Okay? Where are things? So over the years at the university, we've done a number of studies on a concept that we call accessibility. We had an access to destination study funded by the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and we have a more recent study, National Accessibility Evaluation, where we're doing what we did in Minnesota across the United States. We're funded by 9 state DOTs and the U.S. Department of Transportation, and what we're doing is measuring accessibility. I want to talk about this because it's really important to understand why we're in the transportation business in the first place. So the idea of accessibility is how many things you can get to in a given amount of time. So, for instance, in this graphic here, you can see that in the 10-minute circle around the center point, you can't reach any of the destinations. In 20 minutes, you can reach two of them. In 30 minutes, you can reach three of them. Measure of cumulative opportunities, how many destinations, you can think of this, how many jobs you can reach in 30 minutes, and the third example is 3. Okay, 3 is better than 2, but 20 minutes is better than 30 minutes. So we're making a trade-off, and we have to think about both how much you can reach and how quickly you can get there. And we can do this measurement not just for an abstract point, we can do this for the state of Minnesota. And so this map here shows the jobs that are within 30 minutes of every single point in the state of Minnesota. And so, for instance, you can see that the red area around the center, the Twin Cities, you can reach more jobs in 30 minutes than you can in the rural parts of the state. Not surprising, but we can measure this very exactly. You can see where other centers of activity are in Rochester and Duluth and St. Cloud and Mankato. They show up as yellow, not as rich in red as the Twin Cities are, but far more opportunities than in the rest of the state. We could do this at 8 a.m. That was at 6 a.m. We can do this at 8 a.m. Looks almost the same. The difference between the two, that's congestion. The difference between the two is how many fewer jobs you can reach at 8 a.m. than compared to 6 a.m., and that's the cost of congestion. It's not how much time you lose traveling. It's how many fewer opportunities you can reach. And so you can see that there's this ring of congestion around the Twin Cities, and it's higher in the metro area than in the rest of the state because essentially there's no congestion in the rest of the state. I know there are people in Rochester who might complain about that, but comparatively, it's very small compared to the amount of congestion you have here. And you can see how many jobs that you lose at 8 a.m. because, or in this case, it's by driving, because our roads can't move as fast at that time as they do at 6 a.m. when things are essentially free flow speed. So we can blow this up, and you can look and see that there's this nice ring, nice in terms of an elegant ring of loss of accessibility around the center of the city. In the center of the city, you can reach almost as many jobs at 8 a.m. as at 6 a.m. because 30 minutes is a pretty long distance, and you can reach most of the end of the region in 60 minutes. In rural areas, you can't reach very much in 30 minutes anyway, so the congestion doesn't matter. But it matters when you're at the margins between where your commute was 25 minutes at 6 a.m., but now it's 35 minutes at 8 a.m. You lose some time, and you lose some money. And as a consequence, you're losing accessibility. So that example was for automobile, but we can do this for all the modes. Okay, this is what it looks like for transit. Now, this is obviously a blow-up of the Twin Cities. You can see Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's more accessibility in Minneapolis than in downtown St. Paul. There's some along the university. You see there's a node at Snelling and I-94 because there's good connectivity there, and this is because of the express buses along I-94 and the buses now, what's now the A line up and down Snelling Avenue, and you make some nice connections there. And you can see where the accessibility is. But you can also notice that this is on the same scale as the highway map. Okay, so this scale, the highest numbers are in yellow, and on previous, the highest scales were in red. Which means there's a lot less accessibility by transit than there is by automobile. And this is what it looks like by walk. And so you can reach a lot of jobs in downtown Minneapolis walking in 30 minutes. You can reach a good distance. Some in St. Paul, and much fewer through the rest of the region. So clearly access by car is higher than access by transit. And the consequence of this is that more people drive than take the bus or take the train. Okay, but we need to keep in mind that that doesn't mean nobody takes the bus or takes the train, that there's many people who value transit, and it's not just for work trips. So we did this for work trips, but you could do this for any type of activity that people are going to the grocery store, going to the doctor, so on. So who is the transit constituency? Commuters using transit to go to work in the Twin Cities is about 5%. Families using transit, sometimes, most of the time, or always for work or school, is 11%, because even if you're not going to work, maybe somebody in your family is by transit. Families using transit for any purposes is 26%. Right? So this is data from the American Community Survey, and that's a national study that's done by the census. It replaced the census long form, which some of you may remember, and it's done every year currently. We can look at mode shares, how many people use various modes. And this compares 2001 versus 2011. This is data from the Travel Behavior Inventory, which is produced by the Met Council. And we can see, again, automobile is the dominant mode. This is for all trip purposes. But it has shifted measurably and significantly between 2001 and 2011. And non-auto modes have picked up. In particular, walking has picked up significantly over this period, as well as biking and transit to a lesser extent. So this is the nature of the world. This matters because if we're trying to fight congestion, we find out that cities that are congested also have the highest accessibility. And this isn't, I mean, there's a reason for this, because accessibility creates value. So think about where real estate prices are the highest. How much are you paying per square foot for real estate? Well, where you're paying the highest per square foot for real estate is where it is most accessible. And it turns out that that's also the place that's most congested. Okay, and we see this show up in land prices. We see it show up in wages. Where do people make the highest income? Well, they take the highest income in the places that are most accessible because you have to compensate them for the high land prices that are there. This causes demand because there's so many people there because they want to be able to reach a lot of activities in a short period of time. And that creates traffic and it slows speed, and that limits the amount of value created. So can we do things to use that value to invest to improve our accessibility? That's one of the important questions. Okay. So accessible places are more productive because otherwise firms wouldn't pay people extra to live there. So there's a value to this because people being together create more value than if everybody were working alone. That doesn't mean everybody should work in a single building, but there's a balance there, and we need to think about that balance. So that's a background on accessibility. I want to talk about some trends. These are some trends looking at the changes in vehicle kilometers of travel per capita in the United States, starting in 1900 and going through 2016, the most recent year for which data is available. Okay, and we can see the trend on for the automobile rising and rising and rising until we enter the 20th century, the 21st century, and in the 21st century, it basically levels off. Okay, so people aren't traveling any more per capita today than they were in 2004 or 2003. In fact, it's a little bit less. It's more than at the depths of the recession, but it's less than the peak from before the recession. There's a number of reasons for that. We can also look at other things that are happening. This is looking at the transit data. And so looking at the time series change, we can see that transit, on the other hand, and this is passenger trips by public transit per capita, peaked in 1945, 1946 because of the war and the end of the war and the rationing that was taking place during that time. But it really peaked in the 1920s from an economic perspective. And it's basically been falling ever since, leveling out in the 1980s and 1990s. And on a per capita level, it's been flat for essentially the last 3.5 decades. Okay, so we've sort of saturated how much travel people are going to do. We can look at, well, building supply and how much supply of transportation do we have. We can look at roadways per capita. And this is unpaved, and that's been declining, not because we're not building new unpaved roads, but because we're paving them. But we're getting more people, and we're getting more people faster than we're building new roads. And it's basically leveled off the last couple of years. But for a long period of time, we're basically filling up the roads that we built. We're still adding roads, but not adding roads as fast as we're adding population. We can look at the number of cars in the United States. And that rose again through the 20th century, basically flat in the 21st century, picking up in the last couple of years. On a per capita level, it's still well off the peak. People are less likely to own cars than they used to. Okay? Still own a lot of cars. This is data from the American Time Use Survey. So this is how many minutes per day are spent on various activities, and this is on travel to various types of purposes. Data from 2003 through 2013. And we can see personal care, eating and drinking, household activities, goods and services, and it's dropping a little bit, care and helping household members, work, travel to work, for education, schooling, organizational, civic, and religious activities, and leisure and sports. You say, well, data's a little bit noisy, but you can also say that from this time series that in 2003 people were spending about 74 minutes a day traveling, and in 2013 people were spending 68 minutes a day traveling. Say that's only 6 minutes. That's a 10% drop in how much people are traveling, according to the American Time Use Survey. 2014 was also down, is my understanding. I don't have the data graphed here. Okay. So how much travel people do is at least flat. It's probably lowering. Of course, the population is still growing. We can look at data from the Twin Cities looking at person trips per day by age and year of birth. So we can look at some of the demographic factors that are going on. And we can see that the most recent generation, from people who were born between 84 and 93 have fewer person trips per day when they're 18 than the previous generation born between 74 and 83 did in the Blue Diamond, or than my generation, the gray line, 1964 to 1973 did when they were 18. And so we're seeing basically that there's a change in the amount of travel demographically. And this is from the Travel Behavior Inventory. This is data that we analyzed. And we can look at it, average trip distance as well, demographically. And again, the average trip distance for people who are in the most recent age cohort is less, significantly less, than it was for people who are older. And this is in terms of the miles per trip. Okay. Now, we've got changing demographics. Everybody, I'm sure, has seen various versions of this age pyramid, which doesn't look very much like a pyramid anymore because it still narrows up at the top. But there are now fewer people in the younger age cohorts, and if we shut off immigration, that will stay fewer people. So a lot of the people who are coming in, the previously would have migrated in their teens, in their early 20s, might not be migrating into the future, but we can sort of see just from birth that there will be fewer people in future generations than there have been in the most recent generations. We can also see how work changes. This is labor force participation rates from 1948 through early 2017. And we can see that labor force participation rates used to be as high as 68%, and now they're down to about 63%. So fewer people who are of the working age are working, and we can say that this is due to unemployment, but of course unemployment is significantly lower than it was just 8 years ago. And there's other trends at work, okay? So different rates of unemployment you can think about, but it's also a lot of this is perhaps choice. We can look at trends in at-home working. Okay, so maybe people are going to continue to be in the workforce, but they'll work at home. The amount of at-home working sometimes is going up. The amount of people who are never working at home is going down. But the amount of people who are working 4 or 5 days per week at home is actually flat. The blue line at the bottom are declining a little bit. So at-home working might rise in the future, but it's going to be sort of this blended, we work at the office sometimes, we work at the factory sometimes, and we sometimes, probably you don't take too much work home from the factory, but you take some work home from the office and work there. Okay, we can look at the trends for expected trends for telecommuting. So we're roughly at 6% of the population today. Projecting forward, and this is part of the Transportation Futures Project that we did at the university, supported by MnDOT, and this is work that Jason Sow did. We can look at telecommuting trends, and we expect that this will rise, but it's not going to become a dominant feature in our society. It might rise from 6% to 8 or 9% over the next 20 years. Online shopping has become a significant factor, and it's reduced the amount of travel we do for shopping trips. The amount of times that we go to the mall or the shopping center, and it's declined for all demographic groups, males, females, workers, and non-workers since 2001, and significantly below the levels from 1990. And what's coming forward? Well, we can see important trends in terms of electrification of the fleet. Prices for lithium-ion batteries are falling, and they'll fall significantly over the next few years. Electric vehicles are likely to gain market share. This is a country that's a little bit ahead of us from Norway. Starting from about 2% market share in 2011, they're about 22% market share for electric vehicles now. Okay. In the United States, electric vehicle sales, the blue bar is hybrid electric vehicles. The green and the yellow are battery and plug-in, real full electric vehicles. And we can see that while hybrids are going down in terms of market share, EVs are rising, and they're rising at what's going to be an increasingly rapid pace over the next few years. Okay. And we see automation is coming. And our expectation is that automation will come to dominate the fleet over the next 25 years. So by 2040, not only all new cars will be essentially autonomous, but most of the fleet, if not all of the fleet, will be autonomous. And that's going to have a result in many different types of vehicles. We're used to a particular model of vehicle, a set of vehicles that are on the road today, the four-door sedan, the SUV, but many new vehicles become possible once you have the computer doing the driving and you don't have to have as much worry about safety that you do today. So people have seen the Google car. In cities, you might have stackable cars. You can think about sharing as being an idea. Cars could be bigger. You could have conferences in cars. So this is the Toyota Swagger. Okay, they could be smaller. The Toyota iRoad is a single passenger three-wheeled vehicle, basically an enclosed motorcycle. This model is being tested now in Japan. It's not on the road in the U.S. yet. People are probably going to be reluctant to it as long as there's a bunch of other crazy people driving around and being in such a small car. But if all the cars are automated and roads are safe, you don't need to have as large a car to protect you. Okay, so things change. And this comes, evokes GM's lean machine design from the late 1970s, early 1980s, which never went to market. But people have been thinking about what we can do with smaller cars. And if we have smaller cars, our road capacity becomes much more useful to us. We can take much more advantage of the amount of road space that we have. We could be looking at scooters becoming a much more prominent thing. Or maybe we could have unicycles. Probably less likely, but you never know. So, moving towards policy, given these are the changes, we want to improve access, and we have these changes in technology. What should Minnesota be doing? Okay. Well, the first thing that we should be looking at is preservation. The links that we have out there today are far more valuable than anything you can imagine building. Okay, we've built all the best roads. Okay, the first bridge you build across the river is more valuable than the second, and the second's more valuable than the third, and the third's more valuable than the 33rd. So preserving what we have is the most important thing to do. If we lose that capacity, we'll be losing a lot more benefits because people have built that into their current behaviors. They've built that into their current choices about where to build buildings and so on. This is the thing we need to think about most. Make sure that we preserve and make sure everything is structurally sound and unlikely to collapse. Second, we can look at reducing and reusing. Okay. Now, everyone complains about congestion, but if you actually look at roads, most roads are underutilized most of the time. Okay. Most roads are so empty we park cars on them 23 hours a day. Okay. We have a lot of capacity out there. Now, it's not necessarily where we need it at all times, but it's there. And outside of the peak, it's there almost everywhere. So what can we do to manage the capacity that we have better? Okay, and it's not just the roads. Most seats in most cars are empty most of the time. Okay, you're driving around in an SUV, the single person, there's one person occupying a car that will seat seven people. Okay, what can we do about this? Most cars are heavier than they need to be to serve the purpose. You buy the car for the extreme use. I might go to the hardware store on the weekend and carry lumber, so I buy myself a truck, yet most of the time I drive around the truck and I'm just moving a person. Okay. There's a lot of inefficiency in the system, and there's inefficiencies for a reason, but if we think about the system more systematically, we can think, well, maybe we can manage our fleet better. Maybe we can have a different fleet. Think about traffic lights. You drive up to a traffic light and you wait at the traffic light and it's red, and most of the time, not all of the time, most of the time, there's no cars in the other direction. Well, a traffic light's just a dumb light bulb. We're taking instructions from light bulbs. Can we do something better? Yeah, you could do something better. You could give people some judgment back. Certainly autonomous vehicles will be doing some of this. And think about, well, maybe we don't need a traffic light there all the time. Maybe it could be a stop sign. Maybe it could be a flashing red. Maybe it could be a roundabout instead. There's a lot of different designs that we just don't use because we're uncomfortable with them, because people are afraid of them. So thinking about spreading travel away from the peak and then using our capacity better is really important. If we, in fact, get autonomous vehicles are going to add capacity from a number of different ways. They're going to be able to follow each other more closely. They're going to not need as wide a lane. If you use smaller cars, they definitely don't need as wide a lane. So we're going to get a lot more throughput on the pavement with vehicle automation. And that means we need fewer square meters to serve the same number of people. Okay? We need less pavement to serve the same amount of throughput. We should be making investments that have high rates of return. Okay? Now, that sounds obvious, but we don't have strict benefit cost tests for the things that we do in this state. We've gone back and forth and talked about it from time to time, and we've required benefit cost analyses be done from time to time. But we should be focusing on projects that most effectively expand accessibility for all, give you the most benefit per unit cost from an efficiency perspective. Or if you're concerned about equity, those that provide additional accessibility for the people with the fewest opportunities. There's different ways to measure that. Okay, ridership is highly correlated with accessibility. I'm just going to give you an example from transit. You could do exactly the same kind of example from roads, and we can look at the differences in this case, cost per daily passenger mile. And this is data for the various bus and rail transit ways that have been proposed and or built in the Twin Cities. Looking at the Red Line, North Star, the Southwest LRT, this was done in 2013, so the cost may be adjusted one way or another. The Green Line between Minneapolis and St. Paul, the Blue Line between Minneapolis and the airport and Mall of America, and the A Line on Snelling Avenue. And we can look at the cost per daily rider and the cost per daily passenger mile. And we can see that some of these things are not like the others, as they say, and some of them are much more cost-effective in providing transportation service than others. We should be doing those things. We should be doing those things first. And once we've done those things, then we can look at doing the next things. But we're wasting a lot of money doing things that have low cost-effectiveness while there's things with relatively high cost-effectiveness sitting around waiting to be done. We should be making investments that are flexible and adaptable. Okay, the next 50 years, you're going to see a lot more change than the last 50 years did. Cars today would be very familiar to people from 1966. They'd say, oh, they're a little sleeker. That's great. They have an in-vehicle satellite navigation system. That's great. Okay, in 50 years, they're going to look very different. They're going to be automated. They're going to be electric. They're going to behave in different ways. They'll be much different sizes. So we need to think about what kind of investments that we make today will be useful, not just assuming that the technology remains unchanged, but what will be useful if the technology does change. We need to avoid future stranded investments, okay, building things that will become obsolete. And think about what can we do that will improve accessibility today and have the potential to do so tomorrow. Okay. We should be moving decisions down the chain of command. Okay, we should be allowing the local governments to have more autonomy in funding transit, for instance, as well as highways, with their own money. So if a Minnesota city or county wants to tax itself to pay for something, nobody should be stopping them from doing that as long as they democratically decided to do that. So as somebody once said, I think it was Chairman Mao, let 1,000 flowers bloom, and perhaps you could say let 87 flowers bloom. And then we should be looking at how can we get rid of congestion. And we can get rid of congestion if we're willing to do the things that are necessary. They're politically difficult, so I don't expect that to actually happen. But we can move in that direction with things that are less politically difficult and phase them in over time. So start with today's gas tax, which is how we fund about a third to a half of the roads in Minnesota. Okay, we pay for most of the rest of it with general revenue, a lot of which is property tax. Okay, the gas tax doesn't account for cost inflation in the road sector. Okay, it doesn't account for rising fuel efficiency. It doesn't pay for local roads. It doesn't pay for the costs of pollution, which are offloaded to the health sector. The costs of pollution are paid for by society. They're just paid for by people being sicker and going to hospitals sooner than they otherwise would, rather than being paid for by the cars which cause the pollution. Doesn't pay for crashes directly. We pay for insurance, which is independent of the number of miles we drive, essentially. It doesn't raise revenue from vehicles that do not use gasoline for fuel, electric vehicles, which are going to be a larger and larger share of the fleet. It doesn't recover pavement damage from heavy vehicles, certainly not fully. I know the truckers will have arguments with that. In the economic community, it's well understood. And it doesn't address congestion because it doesn't vary by time of day. Okay? Now, we can do some things with the gas tax that will solve some of these problems, and we can do other things that will solve the rest of these problems. We can fix the gas tax. Okay? So, for instance, we could replace the local property tax share that's paid for by roads locally with a higher state gas tax that's returned to local governments. Now, counties don't have the option, I don't believe, to raise the gas tax in Minnesota. They do in some states. But if the county's small enough, it doesn't want to do that because people will go to the next county and buy gas if they didn't. So you have a race to the bottom type of process. If all the counties in Minnesota had the same gas tax, you're not going to have people going across the county line to buy gasoline. And that's one thing that you can do. And you can also replace the motor vehicle sales tax, the portion that's dedicated to roads. Replace that with a gas tax as well. And you say, well, why are we going to replace it with a gas tax? Because the gas tax affects how much people travel. The motor vehicle sales tax does not. I either buy a car or I don't buy a car. But once I have the car, it doesn't affect how much I travel. If we want to do something about congestion, we need to reduce the amount of travel. Okay. This means that there'll be a higher gas or diesel tax. This is a user fee for gasoline and diesel-powered cars and trucks, and it means there'll be a lower property tax. This is a tax swap, okay? And the money goes back to local governments. The second part of it is, to what are we going to do with electric vehicles? Can we phase in a replacement? So electric vehicles don't pay the gas tax, yet they use roads. Now, there's very few of them now, and we want to subsidize electric vehicles because they don't pollute and some other reasons. We can subsidize them in other ways. If we want to retain the highway user fee principle, okay, it means we need to charge electric vehicles. And the advantage of doing that now is there are so few of them that as they become more and more widespread, this becomes a standard operating procedure. There doesn't have to be a big fight when 50% of the cars are electric. Okay. There's not going to be riots if you do it now. There'll be riots in 10 years if you try to do it in 10 years. And I'm against violence if we don't avoid it. So those are my thoughts. Thank you. With that, I'll take questions.
Representative Petersburg, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Professor Levinson. As I was listening to your testimony and your lecture, shall I say, in regards to that, the question I come back to is how you determine accessibility in regards to the number of jobs. Is that a per capita accessibility, or is that just the overall jobs available?
So if I'm measuring accessibility, I'm measuring it, let's say I'm measuring it for a city block. That is, for somebody who's living in that city block, how many jobs can that person reach? Okay, so if I'm living in a block and I can reach 700,000 jobs in 30 minutes, then the accessibility for me or for that block is 700,000. So I'm not dividing it by the total number of people in the Twin Cities. It's not divided. There's obviously more opportunities in the Twin Cities than there are in rural areas. That's why land is more expensive in the Twin Cities.
But isn't there?
Petersburg?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. But isn't there a little bit of a flaw in that, in regards to, if, for example, a city of 100,000 people have 200,000 jobs available, that's two jobs for every person there, versus a town that has maybe only 1,000 people and they have 2,500 jobs, they actually have more accessibility, more jobs than the others. And so, does your formula take that into account?
Well, they do have more accessibility to more jobs. So it does take it into account, and that's and that accurately reflects how many jobs they have access to.
But your okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for that. Your drawing indicates that some of the small communities that may have more than that are not listed as high with accessibility.
But it's
Professor.
But so if I live in a community that has 100,000 jobs that I can reach in 30 minutes, then I have an accessibility of 100,000. If I live in a community that has accessibility to 2,500 jobs within 30 minutes, then I only have an accessibility of 2,500.
Any follow-up?
That's how many jobs I have access to. I mean, you can measure it. I mean, the beauty of this measure, I mean, you can maybe say that you like a different measure, and there are lots of measures. The beauty of this measure is it is measurable. That is, I can observe this. I could physically go out and count the number of workplaces that somebody can reach in a given amount of time. There's not a complicated formula behind this. There's a lot of calculation behind it because they're doing it for so many places, but it's immediately measurable. And it can be compared. And so you can say, well, a small town, of course, has lower accessibility than a large town. Doesn't mean it's a better or worse place. It just means it has fewer jobs available because it does have fewer jobs available.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But your competitiveness, in other words, what you're competing for, the number of people you're competing for that one job out of those 100,000, is a whole lot different underneath that piece. And so when you don't take into consideration the concentration and the concentration of the jobs, you really are saying...
Please go through the chair.
I mean, that's my concern.
So you could also look at the accessibility to labor. And then you can look at how many jobs can you reach net of how many other people are trying to reach those jobs. And so we've done measures like that. I don't have them on this slide deck, but we do have other measures of accessibility that look at access to labor and how many workers can you reach from a given point. So if you're a firm, how big is your job, is your potential job, your labor force? And you can compare those two numbers, and then you can look at the ratio, for instance, of the number of jobs that can be reached versus the number of workers that can be reached. And some places, like downtown Minneapolis, you can reach a lot more jobs than workers, and other places, like suburban areas, have a lot more workers than jobs. Most places are in rough balance. The region as a whole is in balance. That's how the region is defined by the census. It's an area, the commuter shed, where there's roughly an equal number of workers and jobs available. But some places will have more jobs than workers, and other places will have more workers than jobs. And I didn't show the labor slides here, but we do have that in as they say, in the report. If you want, I'm happy to show it to you after the...
That's
okay.
If I can follow, just as a final comment, I'm not going to belabor the point, but I'm just thinking sometimes our statistics, we actually double count things, and when you talk about jobs and how many people are available, all the jobs have that same number of people available, so you can't count them for each individual job. And I'm just concerned that your accessibility issue that you base everything upon may be flawed in the fact that we don't take into consideration concentrated jobs in concentrated areas are going to allow for more expansion of that duplication of things, and so therefore it's going to seem like there's more accessibility than others. And I just have that concern, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Maybe we won't pursue that any further. But, Professor, I wanted to, you used the measurement of 30 minutes. So if you went to 45 minutes and asked the same question, do you have, you've got people that are going to have the accessibility, but it's 45 minutes. And isn't that sort of beyond what is considered accessible?
Right. So you could use any amount of time as your threshold. The reason we choose 30 is, one is it's convenient to use the same for a lot of comparisons, just so you can sort of see it side by side. The average commute time in the Twin Cities is about 25 and a half minutes. So 30 minutes is close to the average commute that people have. It's a little bit higher than the average commute. Few people have commutes above 45 minutes. Not nobody. Obviously, there will be people who will say that they do. But most people don't. And so you can look at that. You would see a similar pattern. It would be spread out differently. It would be redder because, of course, you can reach more jobs in 45 minutes than you can reach in 30 minutes. But you get the same kind of pattern that you would with 30 minutes. People argue that you should use a higher threshold for transit than for automobile because people are more willing to ride on a train, for instance, for a longer period of time than spending the same amount of time actively driving, which is a more intensive activity. When you start doing that, it becomes much more complicated. Obviously, happy to show you the graphs at 30 minutes and 45 minutes, and we have thousands and thousands of these maps. But the same points apply in either case. And there's arguments about these, what should you use for walking or bicycling and so on. But 30 minutes is a convenient comparison, but it's certainly not the only one you can look at.
Okay. We do have about four questioners here, and we're going to try to start with the other presenter. So, Representative Bernardi?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank you for having Professor Levinson, or doctor, I'm not sure what the proper credential is. What's it, professor?
Professor.
Okay, having him here today, and thank you for being here. My question for you is on the recommend policy implications, number 3. It talks about make investments that have a high rate of return. And this is a lot of the work that I'm trying to do and get my arms around, and so when you answer this question, please answer it to us as policymakers. And know that there's the Minnesota Department of Transportation is in the house, and we just had project selection yesterday, how they choose their project. Can you focus on number 3 to provide us with some, just expand on that a little bit, and what we ought to be doing for the future?
Professor Levinson.
So my view is that we should be doing a benefit-cost analysis on projects of all kinds of investments that we're making. So first is sort of a point of information. And then second, use that information to prioritize projects. So the projects that have the highest benefit-cost ratio would be the ones that are the most important to do. Then the question is, well, how do you quantify benefits and how do you quantify costs? And so there's a science to benefit-cost analysis, and there's a bit of an art to benefit-cost analysis. But there are reasonable ways and consistent ways of measuring these benefits. And so often people look at travel time savings from a project, and then they figure that there's a value of that, and there's a what's called a value of time, and that might be on the order of $16 an hour. I don't know what MnDOT's current number is. That's what it was recently. And it's a sort of standard number people use in the United States. It's roughly half of the average wage rate. and you look at the time savings and the value of time, and you multiply those together, and you get a total value of the time saved. And you can look at some other benefits as well. And then you look at costs, and the most obvious costs are the construction costs and the long-term maintenance costs of a project. But there's these other costs that we should be looking at. So we should be thinking about full costs and full benefits. One of the problems with time savings is it doesn't consider the quality.
Madam Chair, I hate to interrupt, but I may not have been clear in my question. And I love this answer, too, but I only have so much time with the answer for my question. Can you focus on the last bullet on that? Focus on projects that are most effectively accessibility for all and fewer opportunities.
Thank you. So when we're looking at the full cost, we have a lot of different things that we should be considering. When we're looking at the full benefits, time savings is only part of that. And accessibility is perhaps a better way, I think it's a better way of looking at this. And you can think about it in terms of the land value that's created. So MnDOT might value something based on the amount of time saved, but nobody actually captures that money. Where is that money captured? It's captured in higher real estate prices. Okay, so land is more valuable where people have more opportunities. So if we looked at the land value that's created, which is essentially a function of the accessibility, the more accessibility you have, the more land value there is, that would be another way of doing a benefit cost analysis or cost effectiveness analysis if you don't want to monetize that directly. In ranking projects. And so you could say how much units of accessibility are provided by this project per dollar compared to how many units of accessibility are provided by another project per dollar. And the one that provides more accessibility per dollar is more efficient from this metric, but generally overall, because accessibility will track with things like usage and other types of measures that we typically care about.
So, all right, so we have a few more questioners. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I had a question regarding three as well, and although I don't think I entirely understood what you were commenting regarding your benefit cost analysis, but would you come to the conclusion that transit and light rail particularly is the best investment for a high rate of return?
Professor Levinson?
I would not come to that conclusion.
Very good.
Representative Barr, Regina.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Professor. You had talked about competing modes, and it listed out auto, transit, bike, walking, school bus, other. And then you talked about making investments that are flexible and adaptable. Can you talk a little bit about what you would see as a good flexible investment in light of some of those modes and the changing trends for transportation that you talked about in the next 50 years?
Professor Levinson?
Sure. So if you think about what's most likely to be important 50 years from now or 100 years from now, think about what was most important and what do we have that's left from 50 or 100 years ago, 150 years ago. We still have our rights of way. And so preserving rights of way is really important because we can use them in a lot of different ways. Okay. We can use them, and we use them to move horses and carriages, and we use pedestrians, and we can move bicycles on them, and we can move buses on them, and we can move streetcars down them. So keeping the right-of-way, that's the most flexible thing. Beyond that, you say, well, what are we going to do that has a rate of return that shows up sooner rather than later? And that means the capital cost, if you make something that has a high capital cost, it may take a long time for that rate of return to be realized. If you look at something that might have a higher operating cost but a lower capital cost, you might realize that rate of return sooner. There's a trade-off there. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on the particular location that you're looking at. And there are certainly corridors. I want to say that in this region, light rail doesn't necessarily have the highest cost effectiveness. That doesn't mean there aren't places that it does. There are corridors where buses are more cost effective than trains. It depends on what your ridership is. It depends on how long do you think that ridership will be there? It depends on what you think is going to be changing. It depends on what your interest rates are and how much it costs to borrow money. Okay, so it depends on some of these macroeconomic forces. And when money is really cheap, borrowing money for capital-intensive things makes a lot of sense. And when the cost of money is expensive, interest rates are high, borrowing money for long-term investments doesn't make as much sense. So there's a lot of trade-offs to be had there. Currently, I think we should be looking at, in the transit sphere, we should be looking at things like the arterial bus, rapid bus system that Metro Transit has put out. I don't think we should be building new highways. in most places. I think we should be largely looking at making the highways that we have work better. Okay, how can we get a better rate of return out of our transportation system? If we can make our traffic lights smarter, that always has a very high rate of return, and we don't spend nearly enough on making sure that our traffic lights are intelligent and are green when there are cars there and are red when there are no cars there. Timing them better, but timing them in real time. It's not, I mean, it's expensive, but it's not nearly as expensive as buying land and disrupting neighborhoods and paving land. So thinking about exploiting the things that we've already built is far more important than building the new things.
Okay. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at some of the graphics you had and showing about benefits of moving around in terms of your reference to real estate values and where people want to be and access, accessibility, you know, it kind of causes me to think a little bit about what we've done over the last five decades since the 60s. In the 60s, as a matter of market reality, the inner cities, there was a massive flight away from them, and suburbs were growing, communities were growing, and suddenly there was a policy shift and a policy change that we can't have that happen. We can't have jobs out in the suburbs. We can't allow people to be through land use and zoning uses. We need to restrict the growth patterns. And it seems like we've created the mess that we have. You know, we should be thinking about maybe some of the policies that would alleviate some of the congestion. Simple things. Most of us who commute on a regular basis, and particularly in the private sector, you notice how much easier it is to get around on a government holiday. The roads are less congested. You know, we might have incentives for people to live close to their place of employment and not be commuting across town.
Is there a question, Representative?
I'm just wondering what your thoughts on that, because really some of the policies that we've adopted, even fiscal disparities, which discourages competition amongst communities to secure jobs and not just be a bedroom community, is corrupting the patterns that might have otherwise ordinarily developed. You know, pre-World War II, everybody walked out their front door and went to work. And, of course, we're a much more specialized society today. I understand that. We're not agrarian anymore. But I think we've made much of the problem that we've are now facing.
Okay. Well, did you care to respond, Professor? Or
A couple of comments. I guess, one, I would agree that trip lengths are increasing. The data all show that trip lengths are increasing. People are commuting longer distances. I'm not sure I agree I agree that we've created the mess that we're in. I believe that's because we're underpricing transportation and people are treating transportation as if it were free because they're not considering the cost that they're imposing on others when they're traveling. When I travel, I don't think about the congestion that I cause you, and therefore I'm not considering that as part of my price of travel, and therefore I consume more transportation than I otherwise would. In terms of the suburbanization of development, there's been a lot of suburbanization development, both on the residential and on the job side, so I'm not exactly sure I understand your point. The job share of downtown Minneapolis is significantly lower than it was 50 years ago, so those jobs have been going to the suburbs. Now, what a unencumbered free market would do, I don't know. I think there are tax policies that affect things both ways inefficiently, and we could work on that. But I think that we need to be focusing on how to get people to realize the full cost of the travel that they're engaged in, and that will lead them to make the right decisions about how much travel they should engage in.
Okay. We want to just finish up in a couple minutes. So Representative Kosnick, and then Hornstein, and then we'll be on to our next presenter. So,
thank you, Chair Rumbeck. And Professor, thanks for being here. I just wonder if you had some comments about our state's use of MinPass lanes, the efficiency that if it's meeting the efficiency that it's intended to, and the effectiveness of the pricing strategy and the overall congestion relief, that if we reduce some of the hours of those operations, if the congestion would be less, and what your thoughts would be on that. Thank you.
Professor Levinson.
So the aim of MinPass is to provide a reliable trip for people who are using MinPass. If you
were to not have separate lanes for MinPass, that is, that they were blended in with the rest of travel, everybody would be in the same congestion. You would have probably slightly less congestion than non-MinPass lanes, but obviously you'd have more congestion for the people previously using MinPass. So the question is there a value for people to be able to buy an uncongested trip? And the rationale behind that is that everybody's in a hurry sometimes. That although I said that we use a value of travel time savings of $16 as an average, in fact, we know that the value of travel time savings is higher for people who are using the MinPass lanes and lower for everybody else on average, and you blend them together to get $16 or whatever. So the important point there is that it's providing a choice where a choice did not exist. Now, are they efficient as they could be? I think that that's still an open question. I think that they're using a reasonable pricing strategy right now, and I have some vested interest in that, and that I did a study of them, and they're using a formula that I helped them modify from their existing process. I think if they made the price the perverse thing that we saw when we did this is when they lowered the price, they saw fewer people using the MinPass lanes, and when they raised the price, they saw more people using the MinPass lanes, because the price itself was a signal of the amount of travel time savings that people thought they were going to get. People are funny, so the exact pricing algorithm, I still think there's a lot of discovery to be done. We've had them for 12 years, but we've only had them in, you know, one quarter for the full length of that time, so there's a lot of experimentation to do. I think it's important to be able, as long as we're not going to price our roads properly, to at least price some of the roads so that people can avoid congestion at the times that they need to. And we can use them for express bus services and other things as well. So it provides, in terms of person throughput, a lot more person throughput on those lanes, even if it doesn't look as visibly congested as the other lanes, than it appears, because you're seeing the density of travel, but we're measuring the flow of travel, and the flow is higher than the density when you're moving. And there's not a lot of flow when everybody's standing still. So from a traffic engineering perspective, there's a good rationale for having something like that. Doesn't mean that they couldn't be improved with more experimentation and more information provided to people and additional thinking about it. But I wouldn't want to write the program off at all.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you for those comments.
All right. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a very quick comment and a very quick question. My quick comment relates to some of the points that Representative Hertas made, and you know, post World War II, and maybe you could verify this. It seems to me that there was a huge public subsidization of infrastructure in the suburbs, roads, all sorts of transportation, sewer interceptors. So it cuts both ways. I think that was a huge government involvement post World War II and in the suburbanization movement. But I wanted to get your quick comment on that, but also you had stated earlier, Professor, that you're a fan of arterial bus rapid transit, as am I. But I wanted maybe you to elaborate a little bit as to why. I think that the A line has been a smashing success. The data shows that, and I think we have another, 15 or so planned. So if you could elaborate a little bit on that point.
Professor Levinson.
So 2 points. Yes, there were a number of subsidies for suburbanization. Federal home loans were another, and the mortgage interest deduction is another that helped encourage people to own real estate in suburban areas. Again, whether or not that's a good thing is another argument, but in fact there has been a number of subsidies for both for suburban development in the post-war period, as well as construction of highways, which some of which was paid for by gas taxes, but certainly not all of it was. In terms of the arterial bus systems, the advantage of that is you're taking advantage of infrastructure that's already there largely. The roads are already there. And you're using that infrastructure more intelligently for buses to move more people. And so the arterial bus rapid transit, like the A line, which if you haven't ridden it, I would encourage you to ride it to sort of see how this works, it's speeds up the bus system because you pay before you board. You can board using all of the doors. The bus stops in the lane, so it doesn't have to pull out into traffic to move along. They're newer facilities that provide information to travelers, so they're attractive to travelers. So you know when the next bus is coming. You don't have this uncertainty with the famous sign in the ground which says bus stop, which doesn't tell you hardly anything. Now, there's a little bit of investment required to do that, but it's a lot less investment than if you're building a whole new infrastructure system to provide that same kind of service. So, again, this is about it's flexible because the capital costs are significantly lower than it would take to move the same number of people by rail or by building a new highway or by building a dedicated busway. So it's cost effective from that perspective. And sort of the data shows that in terms of cost per daily passenger mile, it's significantly lower. So it's moving more people per dollar than the other investments of bus lines or rail lines in the Twin Cities are. And so it's different than, for instance, the Red Line, which runs south from the Mall of America to Lakeville, because it carries more people, but it's also operates on an arterial. It required less infrastructure to build. It doesn't have complex stations. It doesn't have park and ride lots. It serves areas that are denser in terms of population, so you have a better inbuilt transit market. And as with all of these things, you want to go where the market is. And so trying to build something out into a greenfield where there's no market in the hopes that a market will develop is a really speculative investment. Building something where there's a proven market and making it better is a much less risky investment, and you should do the less risky investments first because they have a higher rate of expected rate of return. And so the A line and the other, I don't know how many exactly, that there's a number of B line, C line, D line, and E line have sort of been sketched out in some detail, and other lines, people can draw lines on maps for a long time, but until there's actually money behind them, they're not material. Those are very good transit markets, and this type of service will make them better. Okay, so you'll get more riders per dollar spent on this than just about anything else that you can do.
Thank you, Madam.
Hornstein. All right, thank you. And with that, we'll conclude and move on. But thank you so much, Professor Levinson. Really great stuff to jog our thinking, and I think some excellent points have been made. So,
thank you.
And best of luck in Australia. The professor is has been hired by the University of Sydney, so he's on his way in a few weeks, apparently. So we are going to move on to our next presenter. I don't know if we have. So Randall O'Toole is up next. Are we good? Okay. Randall O'Toole is a Cato Institute Senior Fellow and works on urban growth, public land, and transportation issues, and joins us today from Oregon. So we're very happy to have you here, Mr. O'Toole.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So welcome.
And we seem to be loading up my show. If we just plug in my Macintosh, we're going to save some time here. I appreciate hearing Dr. Levinson's presentation.
Please give us your name and for the
Randall
record,
Randall O'Toole, and I live in Camp Sherman, Oregon, which is 50 miles from nowhere in the middle of the Cascade Mountains. We have a population of 380 people, which is maybe 378 too many for me.
Sounds lovely.
Instead of having rush hour, we have rush second, and you definitely want to avoid that if possible. Are we getting there?
Momentarily, I apologize.
All right. I appreciate listening to Dr. Levinson. A lot of what he says, almost everything he says, I agree with, and a lot of it complements my presentation. There's only going to be a little bit of overlap, and I hope that we can live with that overlap.
It'll be about a minute.
About a minute. You guys have to get Macintosh friendly. It would be instantaneous,
is this
right?
The problem. Okay.
And it would also be helpful if you had a remote microphone for your speakers who like to walk around and wave their arms.
That's an excellent idea too.
But,
somebody's taking notes.
You can
I
hear
hope.
Me now. This might be good enough. All right. Well, I want to start out. I'm going to talk about transportation. I'm also going to talk about metropolitan planning and regional planning. I have a blog, it's called The Anti-Planner, which gives you an idea of how I feel about regional planning. I think it ends up following fads. It covers areas that are too complicated and too big for planners to really understand. So instead of really understanding them, they follow fads, they do what other planners are doing, and you end up seeing cities making the same mistakes over and over and over again. A lot of this was documented many decades ago by Jane Jacobs in a book she wrote, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And in this book, she said two things. She said, city planners don't understand how cities work. Unfortunately, she also then went on to say that she, Jane Jacobs, did understand how cities work. And she was wrong. She was just as wrong as the city planners. She happened to live in Greenwich Village, New York. And so urban planners read her book and said, yes, what we need to do is make every single city in the country look like Greenwich Village, New York. Because that's how she said cities work. She was not too in favor of regional planning. She just defined a region as an area safe and larger than the last area for which we were unable to find any solutions. And what we're seeing now is we have these regional planning agencies. The Metropolitan Council is one that are expanding their authority year by year by expanding the amount of land that they cover. And because they follow fads instead of doing really serving their citizens, they're doing things that I think are very devastating to our economy. They're making housing more and more expensive. They're spending our scarce resources on obsolete transit systems, high-cost, low-capacity transit systems. And they're trying to social engineer people so that they'll live in high-density communities that will therefore serve the transit systems they're providing. In other words, they're trying to make the people serve the transit rather than have transit serve the people. Now, one controversy right now is that the federal government has mandated that all metropolitan planning organizations cover the regions, the urban areas that they cover. And a recent directive from President Obama said that if there are two metropolitan planning organizations in one region, that they will have to either combine or somehow coordinate their planning efforts. So they plan bigger and bigger areas all the time. So we can look at the Twin Cities region, and this is the region as it looked like in 2000. The pink area is the urbanized area, and the yellow area is the rural area. So the Metropolitan Council effectively had authority under the federal government, over the pink urbanized area that's contiguous to Minneapolis and St. Paul. Now, by 2010, the urbanized area, which in this graphic is gray, lapped over into the next two counties. And so it's got a much, also into St. Croix County in Wisconsin. So it now has jurisdiction over more land. That's under the federal MPO requirements that say the MPOs have jurisdiction over more and more areas. If it comes to the point where the St. Cloud metropolitan or urban area touches the Twin Cities urban area, then under the new Obama guidelines, they have to either merge or they have to coordinate, probably merge. There has to be a really good reason for them to not merge, so that the Metropolitan Council will have the same authority over the St. Cloud urban area as it does over the Twin Cities urban area. But even without that, even without the new federal rule under existing, the old federal rules, the jurisdiction now laps over into Sherburne and Wright counties. Not the entire county, just the urbanized portions of those counties. Now that's the federal rule. There's also state law, state legislation giving the Metropolitan Council other authority, tax authority, planning authority, other authority, and under current state law, the Metropolitan Council has a lot of authority within the 7-county metropolitan area, but even if the federal government gives them planning authority over those urbanized areas in Sherburne and Wright counties, the state law currently does not give them any authority over the rest of those counties. Although today it has given them authority over the rest of the counties in the 7-county area, Dakota and Anoka and so on. So I would say don't give them authority over other counties and try to take away some of the authority they have over the existing counties, because I don't think they're doing a good job with those counties. The reason why MPOs were created in the first place was basically to be a pass-through organization for federal grants. The federal government was giving out highway and housing grants to cities. There's 20,000 incorporated cities. There's 3,600 incorporated counties in this country. They didn't want to have to deal with 24,000 grant applications every year. So by mandating the creation of metropolitan planning organizations, there's now about 400 of those. It greatly simplifies the process, and the MPOs can then decide how much money goes to every little county and city in the metropolitan area. The idea that the metropolitan planning organizations have land use authority, though, that comes from the state. The federal government didn't give them any land use planning authority, and yet we see the Metropolitan Council coming up with the Thrive 2040 plan, which is really more of a land use plan than a transportation plan, and I think their land use plan has the potential for doing serious harm to the Twin Cities and Minnesota as a whole. Now, I mentioned that one of the problems with the Metropolitan Council is that they're emphasizing high-cost, low-capacity transit. And by that I mean light rail and commuter rail. Now, people think light rail is high-capacity transit, and Metropolitan Council uses that term, and other light rail agencies use that term to describe light rail, but it's not. It's low-capacity. Yes, one light rail train can hold 450 people. A bus can only hold maybe 60 people for an ordinary bus. A double-decker bus might hold 100 people. So a light rail train can hold more people than a bus. But you can only safely run so many trains an hour. In most cities, you can't run more than 20 trains an hour. So if you have three-car trains holding 450 people, 20 trains an hour, that means you can move 9,000 people an hour on that light rail line. That's the capacity of that line. And most of those people, if the trains are full, will be standing. A minority will be able to sit. Now, Portland, Oregon, my former hometown, had a busway on ordinary downtown streets that was able to serve 160 buses an hour. With ordinary buses holding 40 seated passengers and 20 standees, that busway could move more people than any light rail line, any three-car light rail line. There's two cities in America that have four-car light rail lines, but so they can move 12,000 people an hour, but here you have three-car light rail lines. If you add articulated buses that have 60 seats and room for another 20 or 40 people standing, a total of 100 passengers per bus, then you can even beat out four-car light rail trains. You can move 16,000 people an hour. I was recently in Istanbul, Turkey, and they had a busway that was moving one bus every 14 seconds. That was 260 buses an hour, moving at 50 miles, 60 miles an hour. It was the center of a freeway. It took up no more space than a light rail line, but they put it where they had high demand, and they were moving over the course of a 24-hour period, one bus every 28 seconds, and during rush hour, one bus every 14 seconds. This particular bus can hold 200 people, but that's bigger than our buses. If we just have 100 passenger buses, this a bus lane like that can move 26,000 people an hour. So that's almost three times as many people as a light rail line. So light rail is high cost, low capacity transit. Busways cost less. For most uses, you don't even need dedicated bus lanes. Without dedicated bus lanes on streets, you can move 16,000 people an hour, almost twice as much as light rail lines. Let me give you an example of a city that did it wrong. Denver. In 2004, Denver voters agreed to build six new light rail lines and one bus line. They've now built three of the light rail lines and the bus line. The bus line was the quickest to be built. It was the only one to be built without large cost overruns. It was the only one that didn't have ridership fall well short of predictions. It's the cheapest one, and it's the only one where you can travel from downtown to downtown, downtown Denver to downtown Boulder or whatever. You can travel from one end to the other at faster than 35 miles an hour. The light rail trains mostly go about 20 miles an hour. They had some commuter rail trains that went 35 miles an hour. The bus goes 41 miles an hour on average, including every stop. So the buses are superior, they're cheaper, they're faster, they can move more people per hour. Light rail is simply an obsolete form of transportation. And yet it's a transportation mode of choice by organizations like the Met Council, Portland's Metro, and metropolitan planning organizations all over the country. Now, if we look at cost, we can see that transit is really a high-cost mode of transportation. For a long time, transportation planners talked about getting people out of their cars and onto transit. So we're talking about getting people out of low-cost forms of transportation and onto high-cost forms of transportation. What does that do to your economy? You're spending a lot more to move the same number of people, it drags your economy down. On average, we spend, as consumers, about 40 cents a mile driving our cars. And the average car carries about 1 2/3 people, so that's about 25 cents a mile. And then there are subsidies to driving, but we drive so much, we drive 2.5 trillion miles a year. So subsidies, which add up to, you know, $25-30 billion a year, are about a penny a passenger mile. So total cost of driving, 26 cents a passenger mile. You can see transit is easily over a dollar. And this is the bus here is the bus cost for Met Council buses, Met Transit, Metro Transit buses. Light rail is the Green Line and Hiawatha Line. The commuter line here is the North Star, which is by far the most expensive. So getting people out of their car and on the light rail means getting people out of low-cost transportation and onto high-cost transportation. Buses, the average bus run by the Metro Transit has only 10.5 people in it. If you could increase the load on the buses, you could reduce the cost per passenger mile. You could reduce the subsidy. So I looked up to see which transit agency in the country has the highest load of any. And guess, it was actually number two, Southwest Transit, serving Eden Prairie. The bus agency that's going to be put out of business by the Southwest Rail Line has the highest load factor, 23.5 people per bus at any given time. In other words, 23.5 passenger miles per vehicle mile. Los Angeles, the average bus in Los Angeles is about 19 people per passenger mile, 19 people per bus. Honolulu is about the same. Metro Transit is down there at 10.5. So increasing the load factor or just focusing on routes that have the highest load factors makes buses a lot more cost effective than rail transit. There's also an important hidden cost of rail transit that is totally ignored by the Metropolitan Council and every other agency that wants to build new rail transit lines, and that's the cost of maintenance. They'll tell you the operating costs. They'll tell you that a capital cost, and they'll say, well, the feds are paying for half of that, so we don't have to count that. But then there's maintenance costs. The cars last about 25 years. The rails, the power facilities, and everything else last about 30 years. At the end of that 30-year period, you pretty much have to replace everything. If you don't, this is what you get. This is a crash in Washington, D.C., 30 years after the Washington Metro opened. Their computer systems just stopped working. And two trains ran into each other, killed 9 people, and now their trains are, the ridership is declining. They're having more and more problems every year, or every week, really. They're having huge problems because nobody budgeted for maintenance. The feds paid to build it. The locals paid to operate it. Nobody budgeted for maintenance. They have a $10 billion maintenance backlog, and nobody knows how to fix it. Nationwide, we have a $90 billion maintenance backlog for transit, almost all of which is rail transit. And as newer rail transit systems like Portland's and San Diego's age, that backlog is increasing. Almost no agency is spending even enough money on maintenance to keep the backlog from growing. So the backlog is growing in Boston, in Washington, in Chicago, because they're not even spending enough on transit to keep it from growing. Instead, they're building new transit lines. One person who noticed this was the Obama administration's director of the Federal Transit Administration. His name was Peter Rogoff, and he spent a year visiting transit agencies, and after visiting them, he realized there was a common pattern. First, they complained that their systems were falling apart, and then they'd bring out the four-color glossy brochures and ask him to give them money to build new lines. He said, why should we partner with you to build new lines if you can't afford to maintain what you've got? And he went on to say, paint is cheaper than rails. You take a bus, you paint it a special color, and you can call it a special bus. And you'll get as many new riders as if you built a rail line. Now, he recently retired from the federal government and got a job with Sound Transit in Seattle, who doubled his pay, and now he's advocating for building light rail. But I think he hit the nail on the head. We can't afford to maintain what we've got. Let's not build any more. Let's make better use of what we've got. Let's figure out how to increase the load factors on what we've got. Let's figure out, as Professor Levinson said, figure out how to make our existing highway network work better than what we've got. Let's not expand the authority of the Metropolitan Council when they're making so many bad decisions. Now, the Metropolitan Council's approach to transportation is get people out of their cars, get them onto transit. How are we going to do that? Well, one way is build rail transit. Another way is to have a more compact region. And this is another planning fad, compact city. Goes back to the 1970s at least. And you can see the effects of this by looking at housing prices. Every year, Coldwell Banker estimates the value in thousands of communities across the country, the average price of a four-bedroom, two-bath, 2,200-square-foot house with a family room and a garage in a nice middle-class neighborhood. And in Dallas, for example, in 2016, that house was worth about $241,000. And this is a Macintosh to PC problem. That's supposed to say $241,000 in Dallas. Dallas has zoning, just like Minneapolis and St. Paul, but counties around Dallas are not allowed to zone. So even though it has an MPO, that MPO has no land use authority. The counties have no land use authority outside of the cities. And so that keeps housing affordable because even in the city of Dallas, they know if they had too many regulations on housing, developers would just build outside. So it's affordable throughout the region. That's not true here. That same size of house in Minneapolis is $650,000, according to the Coldwell Banker. In St. Paul, a little less, about $367,000. But still, a lot more than Dallas. Dallas really isn't your competition. Your competition is other cities in the Midwest, some of whom are growing much faster than the Twin Cities. The fastest growing city in the Midwest is Indianapolis, which does not have a strong Metropolitan Council. What's the price of a house there? $202,000. The second fastest growing urban area in the Midwest is Columbus, Ohio, which also does not have a strong Metropolitan Council. Neither Indianapolis nor Columbus are spending a lot of money on light rail transit. In Columbus, that same house, $206,000. So metropolitan planning, aiming to get people out of their car and onto transit, aiming to have compact development, results in unaffordable housing, which results in all kinds of inequities because it makes it harder for people who don't have houses, own houses already, to become homeowners. Reduces home ownership in the long run, particularly hurts minorities who tend to be Hispanics, blacks, and other minorities who tend to have lower incomes. So that's why I'm reluctant to endorse any growth of the expansion of the metropolitan area under the powers of the Metropolitan Council. Now, the other part of the Metropolitan Council's effort to compact the region is through high-density development. They like to call it transit-oriented development. And they aren't as extreme here as they are in my former hometown of Portland. But in Portland, they essentially have said they don't want any new development except high-density development. They don't want any new single-family homes built. They want all new housing to be built to be three and four and five-story buildings along rail lines. transit-oriented developments. Now, I think they really had a backwards view, a dated view of what cities are like. 100 years ago, cities were what were known as monocentric. You had the jobs in the center, you had residents on the outside, and you had rapid transit or streetcar systems moving people to work in the morning and taking them home in the evening. And these monocentric cities only really existed for less than 100 years. In fact, really, 50 years, from about after the Civil War to about 1920. And a lot of urban planning is based on trying to recreate the monocentric city. What happened in 1920, it actually happened in 1913, was that Henry Ford developed the moving assembly line. That made it possible for him to sell cars really cheap, and within 10, 15 years, auto ownership increased by 10 times, mostly Model T Ford. But even more significantly, more and more companies adopted moving assembly lines. Before, you had factories downtown, a factory on an acre of land that might have 4,000 people, 4,000 jobs on that acre of land. Moving assembly lines didn't fit that way. They were all horizontal. They couldn't be vertical. So a moving assembly line factory with 4,000 jobs might cover 300 to 400 acres. That 400 acres couldn't be purchased downtown. You couldn't afford it. So you buy the acres out in the country, out in the suburbs, and you have end up with what's called a polycentric city. You have all these locuses of jobs all over the place and people moving all which way. Some people moving from living downtown and working in the suburbs, some people living in the suburbs and working in other suburbs, some people living in the suburbs and working downtown. And that's the kind of city that prevailed from 1920 to 1980. About 1980, urban planners began to realize the monocentric city no longer existed. They started thinking about the polycentric city, but by that time, they were already out of date again. In 1920, almost half the jobs in America were factory jobs in those moving assembly line factories distributed in polycentric centers around the city. Today, only 10% of jobs in America are factory jobs. And the rest of the jobs are so thinly laid out across the city that you have what I call a nanocentric city, or really a non-centric city. And that's the way cities were before 1850. And now they're that way again, which means transit doesn't work at all. It doesn't work for most people at all, which is why only 2 or 3% of Americans take transit to work, why only 4% of people in the Twin Cities take transit to work. Now, there's a myth that if we build transit lines, fixed guideway transit, like streetcars and light rail, that that will lead to economic development. And yet, even the advocates admit that transit does not influence development. Instead, what you really need to do is you build the transit line, and then you subsidize the development along the transit line, and then you credit the transit line with producing that new development. And so you see, I just looked up online, and it wasn't hard for me to find plans for transit-oriented developments, all of which were subsidized through tax increment financing. This is one in Minneapolis. There's another one in Curry Park, that's I think in Minneapolis. Problem with tax increment financing is that its advocates like to portray it as free money. You say, okay, we've got the base revenues. They're still going to go for schools and fire and police and whatever property taxes go for. But all the increment in revenues is going to go to subsidize the new development. The assumption is you wouldn't have gotten the new development without that increment in revenues. And after you've paid off, you've sold some bonds to subsidize the new development. After you've paid them off, then the money goes to the fire, schools, and police. But in the meantime, you've got this period of time in which you've got new development and the people living in those new developments are sending kids to school and they aren't paying for those schools. They're consuming police and fire and other services and they aren't paying for those services. So everybody else ends up either having to pay higher taxes or get a lower level of services to pay for it. A lot of that increment is just coming from inflation, from increased property prices. And a lot of that increment is coming from development that would have happened anyway. Almost all of it is coming from development, it would have happened anyway. It might not have happened at that particular site, and it might not happen at that particular density, but there isn't any evidence that tax increment financing leads regions to grow faster. And in fact, the best evidence we have is research by some economists in Illinois who found that cities that use tax increment financing actually grow slower than ones that don't. So tax increment financing is not leading to new free money. It's stealing money away from other urban services that then have to either raise taxes or reduce their level of services. So, for example, a fire department in the Denver metropolitan area went to the voters and said, you have to give us a bigger tax rate because tax increment financing has stolen millions of dollars from us. And we need to have higher tax rates. We're not going to be able to put out your fire if your house catches on fire. The Metropolitan Council has a 9-page document called the Transit-Oriented Development Funding Guide that lists 9 pages of different kinds of subsidies you can get for your transit-oriented development. Tax increment financing is only one of them, probably the biggest one. There's a lot of different subsidies out there. That says to me, transit, light rail, commuter rail, whatever, doesn't stimulate development. It only stimulates subsidies to development. Here's a development in, I believe, Fridley. And it's along the North Star line, and it used tax increment financing to get a high-density development. The North Star line, by the way, carried in 2015 1,274 weekday round-trip riders. Now, not every single one of those riders rode every single weekday that year. But assuming somebody rode every single weekday that year, it would have been cheaper to give them a Toyota Prius than to have that train. And not to give them one Toyota Prius. It would have been cheaper to give every single daily round-trip rider of that train a new Toyota Prius every single year that you run the train than it would be to run that train. Now, to me, the substitute for commuter rail is double-decker buses. Double-decker buses can have 80 comfortable seats in them. It's more than an articulated bus, yet the road footprint is no greater than an ordinary standard 40-passenger bus, so they aren't contributing to congestion as much as the articulated buses. They take a little bit longer to load and unload than the articulated buses because they don't have as many doors, but because for commuters, you don't have as many times when you load and unload, you know, if you're going from St. Cloud to St. Paul or whatever for long distances, double-decker buses make a lot of sense. The real advantage of buses is that they don't last very long. Trains last 30 years. So you're stuck with that technology for 30 years. Buses last about 10 years. So when they're worn out, you can replace them with A, a more efficient bus, or B, something that isn't a bus at all because people aren't riding buses anymore. To me, the big problem you have to solve is congestion. It's a $200 billion a year problem. In the Twin Cities, it's a $3 to $4 billion a year problem. And it's the cost of congestion has tripled in the last 25 years. The problem that the Metropolitan Council has decided to solve by providing people with alternatives to congestion, a few people, and everybody else, let them be stuck in traffic. I think there are ways of solving the congestion problem. Dr. Levinson alluded to them. Basically, the thing you need to understand about roads is that the only good whose supply declines when demand increases. At Thanksgiving, the number of seats on the airplane that you want to take to see grandma doesn't decline. In the middle of the summer, when you want to go to a hotel in Glacier National Park, the number of rooms in that hotel doesn't decline because more people want to visit there. But if you're driving on a freeway, when you get more than 2,000 or so vehicles on the road, a freeway lane can move 2,000 vehicles at speed. But when speed starts slowing down because it gets crowded, suddenly the number of vehicles per hour falls off dramatically. It can fall to below 1,000 vehicles an hour. So you've lost half the capacity of your road because a few more people than 2,000 want to use it. So the goal should be to make sure that at no time during the day do more than 2,000 people want to use a road and per lane. And how do you do that? Through road pricing. In Oregon, we're starting to experiment with mileage-based user fees. Be real easy to make them variable price. I was one of the first people to sign up. I have a GPS in my car. It records everywhere I go, and it tells the state one thing, how much I owe each month. I get a rebate on my gas taxes, so I pay no gas tax, and it plugs into the diagnostic board of my car, so I had to fly out one morning, and I got an email from the company that records it, and they said, your battery died. You better recharge it. So it's nice in a lot of ways. Some people say there's privacy concerns. I'm not as concerned about that as other people, but there are ways of doing it without invading people's privacy. The key thing is, with mileage-based user fees, it fixes several things that the gas tax can't fix. One is, it can direct money to the roads that people are using. So when I drove to the airport yesterday, I drove on a private road, a county road, a federal road, a state road, and a city street, and all my money went to the state. All the gas tax money went to the state. Eventually, they'll have it so that when I'm driving on a county road, the mileage-based money I pay goes to the county. When I drive on a federal road, in this case a Forest Service road, it goes to the Forest Service, and so on. But it can also vary so that if I'm driving on a congested road, it can cost a little more during the congested period of the day so that some people will shift to other times. And that's not going to be a huge imposition because only about a third of the vehicles on the road during rush hour are people trying to get to work. So two-thirds of them could shift to another time without making them late for work. Now, I don't even know what this is. Oh, there we are. Okay. Dr. Levinson's talked about automated cars. And so I don't want to spend too much time on that, but we know that automated cars are coming. I've had a chance to ride in a Google automated car in downtown Washington, D.C. It was the safest car on the road because it was the most timid car on the road. But I think we can build them to be a little bit less timid if we want to. We can get enormous benefits. Are we stuck here? Come on. There we go. The benefits of these cars are we can probably get 3 to 4 times as many cars on the road. We can have universal mobility. You don't have to be 16 years old and have a driver's license. I'm looking, you can send your 9-year-old to school in the car. I'm looking forward to be able to load up my dogs in the car and send them to the vet so I don't have to go. Increased speeds because of reduced congestion, increased safety, and a lot less fuel consumed, both because we can build lighter weight cars and because there'll be a lot less congestion. This is a valet parking car. You go to work, and you tell your car, go park yourself, and it drives around until it finds an empty parking place, and it parks itself. Or you could also say, go make some money for me through Uber or something like that. There's a lot of things you can do with your car when you're not using it. The big thing to me that Dr. Levinson didn't mention is that this is going to change our perception of travel time. He mentioned the average commute time in the Twin Cities is about 25 and a half minutes because people have a travel budget. But if you can be at work when you're in the car, you can be producing something or entertaining yourself by watching a DVD or reading a book or doing something like that, that's going to change your value of time. I would suspect it's going to double the amount of time you're willing to spend commuting, from 25 to 50 minutes. So that means people are going to be willing to live a lot further away from downtown. You're going to have far more urban sprawl than we have today. We're going to have more ex-urbanites. We're going to have more people living downtown, too, because it'll be less congested. But I think the sprawl is going to win. I hope we have sound. Is sound hooked up here? Plug that in? Okay. All right, let's see if we can. This is the CEO of Ford. I want to say I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in 2010 that said self-driving cars are going to have as much of an impact on our society as Henry Ford's Model Ts did 100 years ago. This is the president of Ford.
We see autonomous vehicles as having as significant an impact on society as Ford's moving assembly line did over 100 years ago. And that's why today we're announcing Ford's intent to have a high volume SAE Level 4 fully autonomous vehicle in commercial operation in 2021 in a ride-hailing or ride-sharing service. Ford is going to be mass-producing vehicles with full autonomy in 5 years. That means there's going to be no steering wheel, there's not going to be a gas pedal, there's not going to be a brake pedal, and of course, a driver is not going to be required. We're announcing today that we're expanding our presence right here in Silicon Valley from that single research and innovation.
Well, we don't need the rest of that, but this is Google's driverless car. It has no steering wheel, no brake pedal, no accelerator pedal, and they're demonstrating it in Silicon Valley. They're now doing some in Texas because California passed a law. This gentleman, by the way, is blind. California passed a law that actually made it more difficult for them to do that, so they're doing it more of their experiments now in Texas. So this is going to change everything. One of the things that's going to change is you don't want to build long-term systems that aren't going to survive. And Professor Levinson alluded to this, but I just want to say it outright. Rail transit is not going to be able to compete against this. This is going to cost less, and it's going to be accessible to everybody. Anybody who's riding transit today is going to say, hey, why should I take transit when it doesn't go where I want to go, when I have to go out and wait at the curb for a while, when I can just pull up an app, have a self-driving car come and meet me, and for the same price or less, it will take me door-to-door where I want to go, faster and safer. So, yes, have some bus lines, some bus rapid transit lines, because they're going to be easy to convert to lanes for self-driving cars at some point, but don't put a lot of money into high-cost, low-capacity transit systems. I discuss all these issues in my book, Gridlock, and so shameless self-promotion. I brought a few copies with me. You can buy it online for about $13 for the Kindle or electronic version. I'm selling them for $20, but you get my autograph. If you don't want to pay $20, I've written more than 24 reports that the Cato Institute has published, so just go to cato.org. I have reports about autonomous vehicles, I have reports about bus rapid transit, reports about light rail, and all sorts of, and metropolitan area planning as well. All right, thank you. Do you have any questions?
Mr. O'Toole, thank you so much. Really opened our eyes, I think, to some things and raised a lot of questions and so on. So we do have a couple of questioners. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. O'Toole, thanks for the presentation. You kind of answered my question during your presentation, and it had to do with transit-oriented development and the development that does occur along those rail lines. I guess hearing what you said, I would maybe change my question a little bit. Are you aware of any transit lines in the nation that have had any meaningful development along the transit line without further public subsidies?
Mr. O'Toole?
I think there are a few, but I think they tend to be heavy rail transit systems like the San Francisco BART system, the Washington Metro system. And also, the studies show that most of the new development that's inspired by that happens in downtown areas because all of these rapid transit systems are funneling traffic into the downtown areas. And so you get more jobs downtown that might otherwise have dispersed out to the suburbs. What that means is that property owners in the rest of the region lose out. So the region isn't benefiting. It's a trade-off. It's a zero-sum game where some property owners are benefiting and other property owners are being harmed.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein?
Thank you very much. It's good to see you again. I think we were on a panel together at the University of St. Thomas Law School, or
yep,
you were there a few years ago. So just a couple of questions. One is I want to thank you. I appreciated your comments about the mileage-based user fee. And, you know, we had a study group on that a couple years ago, and it just doesn't seem like we're making any progress on that here in Minnesota. I know that you have something in Oregon. And I wanted to just so I have two questions. So my first one is if you could comment a little on what you've done in Oregon, which I think is now a national model for the mileage-based system. And then, well, answer that, and then I'll get to my second question.
Mr. O'Toole.
Well, in Oregon, they just said, anybody want to volunteer to do it? And I said, yes. They said we have 5,000 openings. I think they only got 2,000 volunteers. So I wouldn't say it's been a runaway success. But I think what they're showing is that this is something that can work. It can be cost-effective. The cost of collecting the money is going to be a little bit higher than with the gas tax. But because you can direct the money right to where people are using it, it's much more of an equitable system. And, you know, what I am hoping will happen in Oregon is that they'll simply say, okay, all new cars are going to be exempt from gas taxes. They're going to be using mileage-based user fees. Dr. Levinson said electric cars. I say all cars, all new cars. And then as the fleet replaces itself, we'll just make a transition from gas taxes to mileage-based fees.
So I'm sure I just think this is a really a good idea, and it's one that we ought to listen to Mr. O'Toole on. The second question relates to I just want to read a little from our bill last year, House File 4, which it's kind of grouped highway bus rapid transit and express bus service in the same category as light rail. And so, you know, we have a definition of guideways, intercity passenger rail, commuter rail, light rail, transit, streetcars, and highway bus rapid transit and express bus service operated primarily within a dedicated right-of-way. So the definition of guideway seems to equate those
dedicated
services. And then I think we had some language, I don't agree with it, but it basically sets some additional requirements for an alternatives analysis, et cetera, in the planning process. But it grouped all of those together. And, you know, again, I as I said in my previous comment, I'm a fan of arterial BRT. I think we have a good bipartisan project on 35W, the Orange Line Bus Rapid Transit. Do you think that we should take a second look at grouping all of these guideway projects as equals? Do you agree or disagree that you know, we should talk about highway bus rapid transit and express bus service in the same equivalent way that we talk about these rail projects?
Mr. O'Toole.
Well, I think we're having a national conversation now about what is infrastructure for. And there are some people who think that infrastructure is for creating jobs, building the infrastructure. And they'd be just as happy digging holes and filling them up as doing anything else. And I think it's more sensible to say infrastructure is for producing benefits after the infrastructure is built. And so how do you use your infrastructure most effectively? And the idea that we should have dedicated infrastructure to a relative handful of people, whether it's rail or dedicated bus lanes, to me is silly. There's very few places outside of New York City where a dedicated bus lane can be fully utilized. Just as an example, Los Angeles took an old railroad right-of-way and built dedicated bus lanes, and they run one bus every 4 minutes, which means not compared to what they could do, it's about 96% empty. And if they had opened that up to other vehicles, they could have provided congestion relief for a lot more people than the few people riding one of those one buses every 4 minutes. I want to underscore what Dr. Levinson said, is that shared rights of way are really great. If you have shared rights of way, it's open for bicycles, unicycles, pedestrians, trucks, cars, buses, whatever. But when you dedicate it to one thing, there aren't very many circumstances where I would argue doing that. For safety reasons, sometimes there are reasons for doing that. But just to dedicate it to transit users, no.
And one last quick question, Madam Chair. You had talked a lot about, you know, overbuilding and capacity issues and transit. I think we also have a situation here. We have many, I think, where we've overbuilt road and bridge infrastructure. One that comes to mind to me is the Stillwater Bridge. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but you know, it's a billion-dollar project. I don't dispute that we needed a new bridge to connect Minnesota and Wisconsin on the St. Croix, but there were alternatives for half the cost and a very limited, you know, compared to what the infrastructure is, very limited number of cars and vehicles are going on that. Do you also see waste in our road and bridge building system, you know, bridges to nowhere, et cetera, you know, this being a classic example in our region? Do you see similar problems that you've mentioned in transit also exist in our road and bridge funding scheme?
And Mr. O'Toole, and I think we've reached the end of our session, so if you can close it up with that would be great.
Sure. Now, somebody earlier today asked me what should be the appropriate metric for deciding on a transportation investment. And my answer is that if a new project generates new transportation usage, more passenger miles, more freight ton miles, then that's a positive metric. And so what's the most cost-effective way of producing those passenger miles or ton miles? If building a new bridge that has higher capacity than the existing bridge actually leads to more passenger miles or ton miles, then that's a good thing. That might be worthwhile. Ironically, the anti-highway people, and I don't consider myself pro-highway, but the anti-highway people have said for years that we shouldn't build more highways because they induce demand. They lead to more people using it. You know, they give people more opportunities to get to work. They give people more opportunities to get to low-cost consumer goods or get to better housing. And I don't see what's wrong with that. That's a good thing. That's what we want transportation to do, is to create those increased opportunities. And just one more quick point. Dr. Levinson, you talked about the number of jobs people can reach. I think that might be a little bit more understandable if you said, from the point of view of an employer at any given point on your map, how many people can reach that employer within 30 minutes? And that gives you an estimate of the kind of skilled workforce that employer has access to. If you only have access to 2,000 possible people, you're less likely to get the people who fit your skill needs as if you have access to 1 million people.
Okay. Very good. Great questions. Great presenters. And this meeting is adjourned.